Justice Jimmy Blacklock was appointed to the Texas Supreme Court in January 2018 by Governor Greg Abbott. Now, despite him coming on to replace now Judge Willett, who was the tweeter laureate of Texas, I am reliably informed that Justice Blacklock neither tweets, has a Twitter account, and even is still using a flip phone. he's gonna, yes, this is in fact the case. Before he joined the Texas Supreme Court, he served as Governor Abbott's general counsel and in the Attorney General's office under then AG Abbott. While at the AG's office, he handled appeals and trials of constitutional cases in state and federal court involving matters such as federalism, religious liberty, and the separation of powers. As Deputy Attorney General for legal counsel, he oversaw the open records and opinions division of the Attorney General's office. Earlier in his career, he was appointed by President George W. Bush to serve in the Civil Rights Division in the U.S. Department of Justice, and he worked in private practice in Houston and Austin. He clerked for Judge Jerry Smith on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit after graduating from UT for undergrad and Yale for law school. He's a Houston native who now lives in Austin with his wife and his three daughters. So with that, please welcome Justice Blacklock, who will be moderating the panel.
Thank you. Thank you, Catherine, for that introduction. Thank you all for being here for the last panel of the conference on an afternoon when your stomachs are full and we're following Ted Cruz. That's a hard act to follow. No question about that, but we're going to do our best. You know, I had to campaign last year, and when I talk about judges campaigning, you know, if you need to repair to the fainting couches and grab your smelling salts, you know, please feel free. They're available to you in the back. But I did campaign last year, and I'd campaign with, not with, but at the same event as Ted Cruz. And that's great because for somebody like me who's a very low-profile candidate relative to a Senate race, there's actually a room full of real Texans that you know, packed to the brim, you know, waiting to hear what people have to say, and you don't get to do that very often as a judicial candidate. The problem is that they're all comparing you to Ted Cruz. But today we've got a great panel here on an interesting and important topic, and I just want to welcome you and thank you for coming. We're going to focus on two topics. We'll start with partisan gerrymandering. The overall topic is election issues. We'll start with the issue of partisan gerrymandering, which the Supreme Court addressed earlier this year. I had the opportunity during my time at the Attorney General's office to work on the redistricting litigation that followed, as it always does, the passage of new legislative redistricting maps in 2011 here in Texas, and we won an early 9-0 victory in that case in the Perry versus Perez decision in 2012. But that case was still, it took another 6 or 7 years for that case to get back to the Supreme Court last year when Texas won again. And I think, I don't know the status of it exactly, but I think it's still going on as we're preparing for the election season in which we will elect the legislators who will draw the new maps in 2021. We're still litigating the maps that were drawn in 2011. So for those of us who have worked on these cases over the years, you might say that the Supreme Court's decision this year that we're not gonna have partisan gerrymandering claims is an act of mercy. And it certainly was felt that way at the Texas Attorney General's office, I can imagine. But in so many matters, of course, our Constitution is more concerned with who's going to make a decision than with what that decision should be. And the Supreme Court said that the Constitution authorizes state legislatures and Congress, not the courts, to decide how much politics to inject into the drawing of legislative districts. And we have two panelists here who actually litigated this issue against one another, I believe, and are better positioned than anybody else to talk to us about the Supreme Court's decision in those cases and its aftermath. And then we'll turn to another issue that's drawn a great deal of attention recently, and that's the possibility of reforming the Electoral College. There's actually been litigation over this as well, with a group of plaintiffs bringing so far unsuccessful challenges to winner-take-all Electoral College allocation in Texas, among other states. But the question for us today is not so much whether courts should order changes to the Electoral College, but whether we, the people who are supposed to be running this show, should change the way that we elect our president. Each of our panelists will speak for about 5-10 minutes or so. After that, I may have a question or two for them, but we would really like you to ask any questions that come to mind and hope that you'll fill up most of our time sharing with us what's on your mind and seeking the panelists' input on it. So let me briefly introduce our panelists. Just to my left here, we have Tara Ross. She's the author of Why We Need the Electoral College and The Indispensable Electoral College, How the Founders' Plan Saves Our Country from Mob Rule. So I'll leave some suspense in what side of that debate she's going to take when we get here. She's also written several other books on the topic and related topics. As a lawyer and writer, Tara focuses on the intersection of law, public policy, and constitutional history. She often appears as a guest on a variety of talk shows around the country to discuss matters that address civic, university, and legal audiences. Her work has been published in several law reviews and newspapers, including the National Law Journal, USA Today, and the Washington Times. And this struck me. Her Prager University video, Do You Understand the Electoral College, is PragerU's most viewed video ever, with more than 60 million views. Tara is a retired lawyer and a former editor-in-chief of the Texas Review of Law and Politics. She got a BA from Rice University and a JD from UT. To her left is Nick Stephanopoulos, a professor of law at Chicago University. His research and teaching interests include election law, constitutional law, legislation, administrative law, among others. His scholarship has appeared in law reviews all over the country. And if I can find the rest of my notes, he's written for popular publications as well, including the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, Slate, and Vox. He's been involved in several litigation efforts as well, including the first successful partisan gerrymandering lawsuit in more than 30 years. Before joining the law school faculty, he was an associate in law at Columbia Law School. He previously worked at Jenner and Block in DC, where his practice focused on complex federal litigation and appellate advocacy. And before entering private practice, he clerked for Judge Raymond C. Fisher on the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. He's a 2006 graduate of Yale Law School and also has a degree in European Studies from Cambridge University. To Nick's left is Erin Murphy, a partner at the Washington, D.C. office of Kirkland & Ellis. Her practice focuses on Supreme Court, appellate, and constitutional litigation. She's argued several cases before the Supreme Court, including successfully arguing McCutcheon versus FEC, for which she was named American Lawyers Litigator of the Week. She also successfully argued on behalf of the United States House of Representatives in Texas versus United States. And most recently, she argued on behalf of the Wisconsin State Legislature in Gill versus Whitford, the closely watched partisan gerrymandering case. Erin has been recognized by the National Law Journal as one of the nation's outstanding women lawyers and a rising star, and has been ranked by Chambers and Partners as one of the nation's top appellate lawyers. And finally, on the far left is Patrick Rosenthal. He's a nationally recognized figure in the world of public affairs, international relations, public relations, and market research. Having cut his teeth in the campaign world, including the Forbes for President campaign, Pat has nearly 2 decades of senior-level public affairs experience. During his career, he's advanced initiatives related to national defense, Social Security reform, Medicare Part D, and drug reimportation. Sorry guys, I've got my notes all scrambled here. I didn't memorize your bios before we...
Sounds like enough to me.
Anything else you'd like to say about yourself, Patrick?
I'm a Capricorn.
All right. He's part of the National Popular Vote campaign, a leader in the National Popular Vote campaign, which advocates for reform of the Electoral College. So once again, not a lot of suspense in some of the positions that are going to be taken. But we'll start with partisan gerrymandering, our first topic, and we'll start with Erin Murphy. Take it away.
All right, very good. Well, thank you all for having me down here. It's nice of you to allow non-Texans to come be part of this. I think I get like a little bit of Texas cred because I did actually work on the Abbott v. Perez litigation on behalf of the state of Texas and argued also alongside Scott in the other Texas case. So, you know, I'm doing my part for Texas whenever I can from up in D.C. So Nick and I have been doing kind of, you know, what I would think of as a bit of a traveling roadshow on partisan gerrymandering for like the past, you know, probably 2 years since he first prevailed in the district court in the Gill case. And, you know, normally I have to kind of start out and make my case and make all my own arguments for our side of the case. And if you're kind of perceived as like the pro gerrymandering person, it's not always, you know, the friendliest audience. But you know, I would like to think and have found that at most FedSoc events, folks appreciate that it's really not about being pro-gerrymandering. It's really about, you know, what do we think is the role of the courts in all of this? Well, I think this is the first time since Nick and I have done one of these that I actually finally get to have like someone on my side, because we now know what the court thinks about this, and we actually have a definitive decision from the Supreme Court about whether federal courts can hear partisan gerrymandering claims. So I thought I'd just start with explaining how the Chief Justice explained in this year's Ruccio decision why federal courts should not be hearing these cases, because I don't think I could put it any better than he did. So if you go and you read, Ruccio is a 5-4 decision, a definitive decision in which the court explicitly held that partisan gerrymandering claims are non-justiciable. We didn't have any concurrences or any kind of goofy things like we've had in all the many cases before this. So we finally really do have definitive word from the Supreme Court. And I think the opinion itself really just speaks for exactly why, you know, there are a lot of concerns about the idea of courts being involved in policing whether drawing maps has become too partisan. And the Chief's opinion starts out by explaining what I think is a really important point to recognize in all of this. While I'm sure everybody will say that partisan gerrymandering is at its height today and as bad as it has ever been, there's really nothing new about partisan gerrymandering. I mean, it's been going on since the beginning of our country. It's actually been going on since before we even had a country. The term gerrymandering goes all the way back to the 1800s when a well-known governor named, actually Gary, had an infamous map that looked like a salamander to try to essentially gerrymander the state of Massachusetts. If you go back to the founding, Patrick Henry tried to gerrymander James Madison out of the first Congress. So this isn't like a new phenomenon. And the reason the court thought that was important in explaining in kind of its path to getting to the conclusion that courts shouldn't hear these cases is because it demonstrates that when the framers decided to have legislatures draw the maps, they understood what they were doing. In fact, if you go back to the debates about the elections clause in the Constitution, they actually debated the proposition and said, hey, if we give this power to legislatures, you know, there's a real opportunity for abuse. They're going to make laws in a way that they think will result in, you know, their best chances at getting themselves elected or getting who they want elected. And they understood that. And they said, we nonetheless, you know, think the right thing to do is have the legislatures be the ones who make these laws and who do these maps. And they created checks and balances in between, as between the roles of the states and the federal government. But what they did not do is say, you know, and then at the end of the day, we'll have the judiciary step in and decide what they think of the maps and redraw them if they don't like them. And that's because, you know, it's always been viewed as these really are policy choices. There's a lot of policy involved in how you draw a map. It's anyone who's ever kind of understood how this happens and learned about the software and all the things that go into it. I mean, there are just inherently policy-laden calls that, you know, as a general matter, we've set up a structure in which we allow those types of calls to be made by our elected officials, not unelected members of the government. And so the court, you know, kind of started there And started there because once you establish and understand that this is something that we always understood would be part of our constitutional structure, then you really have to take off the table any theory that tries to say that any degree of districting for partisan advantage or passing laws that are designed to achieve partisan advantage is unconstitutional. Because to say that and to adopt any theory that really is based on the notion that it is per se unconstitutional to engage in districting on the basis of partisan advantage would really be to say that the Constitution unconstitutionally gave to legislatures the power to draw maps. Now, many people may think it's a bad policy call for legislatures to draw maps, and that's a debate that's ongoing, but that's a debate that's distinct from the question of does the Constitution prohibit this? I think that just went off, but now it's back. So the court kind of started there, and having said, look, we can't accept any of the theories that would say this is per se unconstitutional, what you then get to is the question of, is there a theory by which you could decide kind of when it goes too far, how much partisan advantage is too much, how much, gerrymandering is crosses some sort of constitutional line. And the tricky part about that question is, well, if you're going to have a constitutional line for how much is too much, it has to be grounded in an actual constitutional principle. And the problem is, really, other than the theories that just say any degree is too much, all the theories that try to identify how much is too much ultimately reduce to theories about proportional representation. They have something to do in various, some are more aggressively proportional representation, some like Nick's theory is a little less aggressively proportional representation, but they do all have something to do with the notion that there should be a relationship between kind of how many votes on a statewide basis a particular party gets and how many seats that party gets in the legislature. And the problem is, again, while that's, there's nothing wrong with that, we could debate whether that's a good or a bad policy idea, it's clearly not a constitutional principle. Our Constitution unambiguously, no one has ever suggested otherwise, requires proportional representation or anything like it, and we have no historical tradition of proportional representation. We, in fact, have a historical tradition of districting in which it's winner-take-all, and when you have that kind of districting scheme, you inevitably can have results that are very disproportionate because you're not trying to achieve proportional representation. And so I think what the court found in thinking about and asking the question of, is there a way that the judiciary could look at these claims and have an objective and constitutionally grounded test for saying which maps are constitutional and which ones aren't, they found that everything that's ever been put out there just comes up short because they really would require the court to decide for itself policy judgments in the first instance about how maps should be drawn and then effectuate those through the guise of some sort of constitutional analysis of maps. So at this point, we know that these claims are out of the federal courts and seem to be out of the federal courts for good. I think the thing that will be interesting and critical for all of us to watch is, does that make any real difference at all? Or are they all just going to go and be litigated in the state courts? And I think time is, that is a question that's very much still evolving and that we'll see. There's been very much strategic litigation choices about where to press the issues and which state courts to try to go to. And different states have different laws that may or may not be more supportive of efforts to try to get the judiciary involved depending on what you have done. And in fact, part of the reason the Supreme Court said, that this was not an area for the federal judiciary to get involved in is because it said, look, there are political solutions, there are things states can do. We happen to be at a time when, nearly half the states at this point are moving toward having independent districting commissions and exploring other options to see if they think there are better opportunities out there and better ways to do this than to have the legislatures be the ones drawing the maps, but at least at this point we do have a definitive conclusion that the one entity that's not going to be redrawing the maps in the partisan realm anymore is the federal courts.
All right, great. Thank you, Erin. I wonder if I can get my slide presentation loaded. Terrific. Great. So hi, everybody. So as you can tell from this event, with Aaron on one side and me on the other side, partisan gerrymandering has become an ideological issue. You know, it's something that people on the right and people on the left tend to disagree about. And I think that's odd and unfortunate. And I want to talk today about why conservatives ought to oppose gerrymandering and oppose the court's decision in Rucho and support judicial intervention to halt gerrymandering. And in particular, I want to make four points. One is that historically, conservatives have not been at all nonchalant about gerrymandering. Second, that in cases that aren't about gerrymandering, conservative Supreme Court justices have been happy to cite the same democratic values that require judicial intervention against gerrymandering. Third, that to the extent some conservatives don't want action against gerrymandering because they think they benefit from gerrymandering, that view will probably not hold in the next redistricting cycle. And lastly, that everyone, liberal or conservative, ought to be very, very afraid of the new redistricting Wild West in which we now find ourselves. So let me start with the first point, that historically conservatives have been just as worried about gerrymandering and just as supportive of judicial intervention against gerrymandering as liberals. Here's a quote. Partisan gerrymandering is readily identifiable, as are the victims of gerrymandering, who are those who support a particular political party. The fundamental importance of this issue compels the court to establish a general framework to assess such claims. That was a passage from the Republican National Committee's amicus brief in Davis v. Bandemer, which is the 1986 Supreme Court case that held for the first time that partisan gerrymandering is justiciable. And notably, of the six justices in the majority in Bandemer who agreed that partisan gerrymandering is not a political question, three were Republican appointees. This was not a 5-4 Democratic-Republican vote in Bandemer. Here's another quote. We're asking for an end to the anti-democratic and un-American practice of gerrymandering congressional districts. Gerrymandering has become a national scandal. The state legislatures have so rigged the electoral process that the will of the people cannot be heard. That was Ronald Reagan in a 1988 speech. And later in the same speech, he praised a lawsuit against a Democratic gerrymander in California, one of the most egregious of the 1980s gerrymanders. Here's one more quote. Extreme partisan gerrymandering harms our political system. It cannot be reconciled with the framers' conception of the House of Representatives as directly accountable to the people. This court has a crucial role to play in fixing a problem. That's not from the 80s. That's from an amicus brief filed earlier this year by 20 Republican and 20 Democratic members of Congress. So even today, at least some conservative politicians are still willing to stand with Ronald Reagan and condemn partisan gerrymandering. Let me turn next to my second point, which has to do with conservative justices on the Supreme Court. So in Rucho, as Aaron described, these justices scoffed at the idea that the court should step in to correct flaws in our democratic process. But in other cases, cases that aren't about gerrymandering, these same justices have supported judicial intervention against laws that protect incumbents or suppress competition or otherwise undermine democratic values. But of course, that's the exact same logic that supports judicial intervention against gerrymandering. So here, for example, is Justice Scalia in McConnell v. FEC. The first instinct of power is the retention of power. The court must be equipped to resist the incumbent's writing of the rules of political debate. Well, you know, when else incumbents write the rules of political debate? When they design a district plan that has the effect of entrenching themselves in office. Here's a quote from Justice Alito in Davis v. FEC. The Constitution confers upon voters, not the legislature, the power to choose the members of the House of Representatives, and it is a dangerous business for the legislature to use the election laws to influence the voters' choices. Well, you know when else the legislature uses the election laws to influence the voters' choices? When it draws districts to help one party and to harm the other side. Just one more. Here's Chief Justice Roberts in McCutcheon v. FEC, a case Aaron argued. Those who govern should be the last people to help decide who should govern. Well, that's a great argument. It's the classic argument for taking the power to draw district lines away from the politicians who are then going to be the ones running in those same districts. Roberts goes on, the government must not compromise the political responsiveness at the heart of the democratic process or favor some participants in the process over others. Well, what does gerrymandering do if not compromise political responsiveness or favor some participants in the process over others? You know, that is a pithy encapsulation of exactly what gerrymandering is. Okay, let me move on to my third point, which is that, you know, there are probably some folks out there, I'm sure nobody in this room, who opposes action against gerrymandering out of a view that conservatives and Republicans are typically the beneficiaries of gerrymandering. Now, as you can see in this chart, which shows you the proportion of district maps designed by different actors by decade, it's certainly true that in the 2010s, in the current cycle, most district maps were passed by unified Republican governments. And therefore were biased in a Republican direction. But this decade is a real aberration. You know, there's this decade. In the four previous decades, Republican-drawn maps were the least common category. So for 40 years in a row, maps drawn by unified Democratic governments or maps drawn by other actors like courts or commissions or divided governments were more prevalent than Republican maps. And what's more, this decade's aberration almost certainly won't repeat in the 2020 redistricting cycle. So here are seven states where Republicans drew extremely biased maps in this decade. Michigan, Missouri, North Carolina, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Virginia, and Wisconsin. Republicans won't be able to draw the lines in any of those states in the next cycle, either because an independent commission has been adopted or because state courts have done what Russo thought was impossible and they've stepped in to curb gerrymandering, or because control of the state government is now divided. In contrast, a whole bunch of this decade's pro-democratic maps will probably be pro-democratic in the next cycle as well. So in Illinois, Maryland, Massachusetts, Nevada, New York, and Oregon, Democrats are likely to control the state government in the 2020 cycle, and therefore likely to gerrymander in this post-Russo world very aggressively in their favor. The takeaway is that the overall national landscape of the current cycle, which dramatically benefited Republicans, is extremely unusual and will almost certainly not repeat in the next cycle, where we will likely have a much more balanced national environment. Okay, let me turn to my last point, which is that there are a whole bunch of novel gerrymandering techniques out there that we're likely to see in the very near future, now that Russo has made it completely clear that federal courts are out of the ballgame, you know, sitting on their hands on the sidelines. And I think whether you're a conservative or a liberal, you should be very worried about the potency of these methods to subvert the will of the electorate. So one new technique is the use of individual level voter data to draw districts, as opposed to the traditional approach of aggregating election results at the precinct level, or even higher levels. Both parties now have databases that assign partisan scores to every single American. Those individual level scores enable much more precise, much more calibrated gerrymandering than we've ever seen previously. Probably even more potent is the rise of computer algorithms. So computer software that generates enormous numbers of district maps based on whatever criteria the programmer specifies. Redistricting, I think, is one more area where we're finding out that computers are better than people. They can draw lopsided, durable gerrymanders that look lovely to the naked eye. And we're about to see the dawn of this new sort of computer-enabled gerrymandering in the next couple of years. Third, we're also likely to see non-contiguous districts in the next cycle, districts that are made up of entirely unconnected pieces of land. More than half the states allow non-contiguous districts to be drawn. And so now, post-Rucho, there's no reason for my home state of Illinois, for example, not to draw a district that has 55% Democrats in Chicago, joined non-contiguously with 45% Republicans in Peoria, 200 miles away. Hasn't been done, could be done, will be done in the next few years. And lastly, endless redistricting. So one more thing that most states permit is redistricting, redrawing district lines in the middle of the decade. Post-Rucho, nothing is stopping a party that sees a given district slipping away from just redrawing that district. You know, there's no reason to lose the district, just change its boundaries to make it safe once again. And a party doesn't have to do this just once. A party can redraw districts as often as it wants to. It can redraw districts before every single election to make sure that every district map in every year is as finely tuned as possible to benefit that party. So this is the brave new world we're living in post-Rucho. And I hope you'll all agree that it is an awful new world that we're in, and a world we shouldn't be in, and a world that hopefully we can find some way out of going forward. Thanks.
So, switching gears to the Electoral College, Tara.
Hi, thanks everybody for sticking around for the last panel. It's good to be in my home state of Texas. With a friendly crowd. Next week I'm going to be in New York in the complete opposite situation at about, well, 6 days from now I'll be in New York speaking to a New York crowd about the Electoral College. I'm sure I'll be their favorite person in the room. So I don't need to tell you guys that the Electoral College has become contentious lately. There's been a lot of turmoil. You got AOC tweeting out criticisms or posting Instagram stories where she points out her window and criticizes, you know, all the empty land going by and saying the Electoral College is to blame. And there are some allegations that the Electoral College is biased. Is the Electoral College biased in favor of Democrats? Republicans keep winning the Electoral College and losing the popular vote. Is this a big problem? Well, no, the Electoral College is not biased. If we all stop and take a deep breath and look at history, what we will see is that the Electoral College always does the best, or rewards the presidency to the candidate or political party that is doing the best job of coalition building and of reaching out to a wide variety of voters. And if you look at the history of voting, what you see is that it's like a pendulum. It swings back and forth. First, it seems like the Electoral College advantage is for the Democrats, and then it seems like it's for the Republicans. Back and forth. You guys remember as well as I do that in the 80s, Ronald Reagan had what seemed to be an invincible lock on the Electoral College. Texas and California were both voting for Ronald Reagan. How could anybody hope to compete with that until Bill Clinton did, not that long later, and won a bunch of states that had not voted blue in a while? And then, of course, you end up in the situation where Hillary Clinton allegedly has you can't possibly overcome that Electoral College advantage that she has, and of course we all know how that turned out. So my only point is just the Electoral College has no partisan bias. It doesn't favor either political party. It just strives to encourage presidential candidates to reach out to a wide variety of voters. Usually at this point, I kind of describe how the Electoral College works. I'm sitting in a room full of lawyers, so I really hope you guys kind of have the basic outline, but I'll hit it real quick. Of course, we have a two-part election in this country. On election day, you go to the polls and you might see the candidate's name on the ballot, but of course, you're not really voting for those candidates. You're voting for a slate of electors that's behind the candidate, Republican, Democratic, or third party. Each state makes its own decision on how it's going to award those electors, usually winner take all, to the winner of the state popular vote. And it takes a majority of those electors, 270, to win the election. And if nobody gets to 270, we have something called a House contingent election, in which the House will actually decide, voting by state delegation, who is the president of the United States. Now, a lot of people think that this is all too complicated. Why do we have this? This is ridiculous. Why don't we just have a straight up national popular vote and call it a day? Well, the reason is because the founders were students of history, and they knew the history of past failed democracies. And they knew that a simple democracy was not gonna work. 51%, or worse than that, a plurality, shouldn't be able to boss around the rest of the country based on whim or emotion. Or you can imagine in the wake of 9/11, what kind of tyranny a bare majority could impose on the rest of the country just because they're afraid, you know, and they don't know what to do. Emotions can grip a mob and make that kind of governance very unfair. So the founders, as we know, created checks and balances and separation of powers, and the Electoral College is one of these devices that is simply meant to slow down irrational or emotional majorities, and of course they especially wanted to protect the small states. The small states were very, very concerned about being bullied by the big states of the time, like Virginia and New York. So as I said, historically this has worked out well for us, and we have a system that encourages moderation and compromise and working together even when we don't want to sometimes. If you look historically back at how the Electoral College has worked, that's what it does, and it's because you have to win in different parts of the country, in different regions, in different states, in order to get anywhere. I'm not gonna spend a lot of time on this because I only have 5 to 8 minutes or whatever, but historically, that has been the benefit. And what I really wanna talk about is, okay, Tara, those are pretty words about moderation and compromise. We all know what happened in 2016, right? Okay, I'm sitting in a room that might be happy about that outcome, but you guys can see as well as I can, it's angry out there. It's divisive. And this talk of moderation and compromise, that doesn't seem to be what's happening. So I'm going to make an observation. The observation is that both parties are broken. Neither party's doing a great job of what the Electoral College asks us to do. And we are, in fact, in a period of time that is a whole lot like the years after the Civil War. After the Civil War, honestly, it's almost exactly the same. There were two elections where the recorded popular vote was different, of course, than the Electoral College vote. There was division, there was anger. It was very series of very close elections, one after another. And over time, the Electoral College brought us to a place where we had to get past that. Okay, it took several election cycles. People are stubborn then, stubborn now, but you had to. And the reason you have to is because Democrats literally at the time in the South could not win an election, period, unless they figured out how to reach out to somebody on the other side of the political aisle. Republicans were in a similar boat, but they could win with their safe areas, but if they lost anything at all to Democrats, then they were not gonna get the White House either. And so over time, again, people are stubborn, so it took them a couple cycles to figure it out, but they did. And soon we have Coolidge winning in landslides, FDR winning in even bigger landslides. The country came back together and came to a better place. So what I would argue right now is that the Electoral College probably needs to be better understood by most of the public, but it's an important device, and getting rid of it now because we're angry at the other side is the worst possible timing to get rid of the Electoral College. It's actually a moment in our history where we need it more than ever. And so I would, of course, advocate for keeping it. And I'll wrap it up so we can get to questions.
Thank you, Tara. Pat?
Yeah, hi. Thanks for the opportunity to be here. Is my microphone on? Is that working?
Okay, cool. Well, I was getting ready and getting prepared for this talk. This isn't the way I would normally do it, right? I would come out as a full-throated proponent of the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact, which is the only subject I'm here to talk about. But I take seriously the audience, and I know this is the Federalist Society of Texas, so I went to your website, and I read the mission statement, 100% of which I agree with. That was the first time I was ever introduced in my life as the panelist on the far left. That's not my political ideology. I am a conservative Republican trapped behind the blue wall in Minnesota. We voted for Walter Mondale for president, so in my entire adult life, my vote has not mattered in the election of the president of the United States. But when I read sort of the mission statement of the Texas Federalist Society, it said, we're dedicated to the principles that the state exists to preserve liberty, that the spectrum of the separation of government powers is central to our Constitution, and that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it should be, right? So I'm gonna try to respect that mission statement as it relates to the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact. I don't think anybody here needs to decide whether they're for or against the national popular vote or what they think the law should be. They should probably consider the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact on what the law says. And so the idea that we either have an electoral college or a popular vote for president, if you know anything about the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact, is an absolute false choice. Because the way the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact works is that you go to the various legislators and you ask them if they believe it's in the better interest of the citizens of their state to award their electors on the basis of the national popular vote, or do they believe it's better to keep their current state-based winner-take-all law, which is a simple state statute that was never argued, never discussed, and never voted on at the Constitutional Convention. And you will not find the state-based winner-take-all law mentioned anywhere in the Federalist Papers or in the United States Constitution. What the Electoral College is it's governed by Article 2, Section 1 of the Constitution, where we can get to what the law is. Article 2, Section 1 of the Constitution does not require a legal professor to explain to me what it is. It says in 17 words that each state shall appoint in such manner as the legislature thereof may direct a number of electors. There is no restriction to that power as long as the legislature determines how they choose to award the electors that is in the best interest of their state or in the best interest of their citizens. Now, the state-based winner-take-all law was not adopted by a majority of the states until the 11th presidential election, okay? Generations after the founders were dead. It was adopted in the lead-up to the Civil War or the War of Northern Aggression, depending on where you come from, so that the North and the South would have reliable slates of electors that were consolidated, that would consolidate the political party of each state, where who got the most electoral votes from the North or the South was incredibly relevant in terms of the political, cultural, and economic interests of the states. Okay, so I understand why states adopted the state-based winner-take-all system. In the first presidential election, there were states that chose a slate of electors by the governor, right? Council of the governor that appointed would choose the slate of electors. Or in South Carolina, the legislature would select the electors. Or in a big state like Virginia, they had what were called presidential elector districts. Well, what happens in the third presidential election is the state of Virginia, to consolidate the political power of the state of Virginia, after its favorite son, Thomas Jefferson, loses the election of 1796 because the Federalists were able to cherry pick one elector out of that district, he summons the legislature and says, with your power, I want you to move to a unit rule, the state-based winner-take-all law. That was the biggest state of the time exercising its political influence because it was the largest state at the time with the most electors to secure a result, okay? So I think when you think about the state-based winner-take-all system and the Electoral College, understand that you're not stuck with the state-based winner-take-all law if you believe the current system is broken. And the idea that it forces candidates or presidents to build large coalitions of voters ignores a very basic political fact, which is the battleground states of America under the state-based winner-take-all system, of which Texas is not one. And if it ever becomes one, God help us, right? But the truth is the battleground states in America choose the president of the United States and have all of the political influence with the president, okay? 96% of the 2016 presidential campaign occurred in just 12 states, and Texas was not one of them. 100% of the 2012 campaign, I think I said 96% of the 2016 campaign, but 100% of the 2012 campaign happened in just 12 battleground states. If you know anything about presidential politics, you know, for example, Ari Fleischer taught us in a famous quote where he said, 3 years before we ran for re-election, meaning the Bush administration, we were polling in just 18 states, which means 32 states were wholly ignored by their commander-in-chief. And that kind of political system has incredible sort of bad policy implications, I believe, for the conservative movement. Right? We pass a $1 trillion prescription drug benefit to lock in voters of the I-4 corridor of Florida, because if you can't win Florida, the battleground state is a Republican, you cannot be elected president of the United States. No Child Left Behind was what do minivan-driving moms from Hamilton County, Ohio, want to hear from an education president? It's the largest federal intrusion in public education in our lifetime. But I think from a legal context, the only question you have to decide as lawyers or judges, right, is the national popular vote interstate compact within the confines of American jurisprudence and law, right? And so Article 2, Section 1 of the Constitution that says each state shall appoint in such manner as the legislature thereof may direct means that 16 states that have already passed our law, fully vetted by counsel of both parties with 196 electoral votes, are acting within the sort of confines of the second of Article 2, Section 1 of the Constitution. The only other matter of law is Article 1, Section 10, which is a question about whether or not states can form agreements amongst themselves. They're called interstate compacts. They predate the Republic. Every state is in thousands of these. So as it relates to the law, we don't have to really get bogged down in the policy, though I'm more than happy to have that discussion as a conservative Republican about why I prefer the national popular vote interstate compact to the state-based winner-take-all system. As a matter of law, you need to read Article 2, Section 1 of the Constitution, Article 1, Section 10 of the Constitution, and the 888 words that are the national popular vote interstate compact to understand that it does three things, right? One, it preserves the state power to award electors under Article 2, Section 1 of the Constitution, right? Two, it guarantees the presidency when there are states with 270 or more electoral votes with that law in place. It guarantees the presidency to the candidate who gets the most popular votes in all 50 states in the District of Columbia through the Electoral College. And three is, I believe it makes every voter in every state politically relevant in every presidential election, which can end the false crises around the American presidency, where we don't have to wear a jersey every 4 years. We can support our ideas, we can support our candidates, we can win elections, we can live with the result and regroup to win the next one if we don't like the result. And so for all those reasons, I believe the national popular vote is an appropriate topic, obviously for the Federalist Society. Grateful that you would have this panel, and grateful you'd give me some time to make my case.
Well, thank you, everybody, for those remarks. We started a little late, but we'll try and finish relatively on time. We do have some time for questions. Does anybody have anything they'd like to ask? Do we want to get to microphones, or? Yeah, let's do it that way. Maybe line up at the mic so that we catch your question.
I'm intrigued that you spent so much time talking about the constitutionality of the interstate compact. I thought that was a given. The policy is what's interesting to me. It seems like there is an opposite way that we could go to accomplish the same rebalancing. Reflecting back on Alexander Hamilton's proposed amendment to go to single member districts, congressional districts, if you will, for the selection of electoral votes. And I wonder if you've done any study on how that would reflect conservative versus liberal. Yes.
Well, I think a congressional district system, again, my policy priority with the national popular vote, and the only reason I support a national popular vote is to make every voter in every state politically relevant in every presidential election. And I believe a congressional district system takes a bad system and makes it worse. If you buy into sort of my premise, which I think you would have to buy into in order to be a proponent of reform, that battleground voters have more political influence under the current system, you know, there are probably about 65 competitive congressional districts in a presidential election every 4 years. And so right now, what the voters of the I-4 corridor of Florida want, they get because they're a swing state. In my home state, the first congressional district of Minnesota, right, would be the only competitive congressional district. And I think we saw that play out in Nebraska when Barack Obama was able to win the second congressional district because they have a congressional district system. As soon as the Republicans figured out Obama could make that competitive, their first order of business was to go back to a winner-take-all law, right? Their second order of business was to change the district and deal with it through redistricting and gerrymandering. But the truth is it makes the second congressional district voter in Nebraska really, really, really powerful under a congressional district system, and the first and third district voters are completely ignored. As a matter of fact, they pay $10 for a lawn sign that makes, you know, takes $3 to make because they can't possibly be competitive. So my sense is let's have a system where every American voter, no matter what zip code they live in, is politically relevant. Let's have a system where we line up and beat the opponent based on our ideas, and national popular vote's the only way to deliver that promise, and the compact's the only way that I would support the reform.
So I'm going to pipe in and say, look, one of the great things about the Electoral College that Pat and I are going to agree on is that every state can do what it wants to do. And if some state wants to allocate their electors by congressional district, then more power to them. Maine and Nebraska already do that. I will also agree that that's going to turn into a bigger problem than people realize because of the gerrymandering issue in the middle of this panel. But every state can do what they want to do. Now, where I disagree with Pat is I've heard several comments here that this national popular vote interstate compact is perfectly constitutional and it's just fine and it's just states exercising their discretion to do what they want to do. Well, no. I mean, if California really thinks that it's in California's best interest to give its electors, its 55 electors, to the winner of the national popular vote, then it will do that now today with no compact, without needing everybody else to jump on board. But California doesn't think that this is in the best interest of California. California thinks that they want to change the presidential election system, and they don't like the decentralized federalist form that we have now. And so they are using this interstate compact as an end run around Article 5 of the Constitution. And in fact, if you talk to the people who started NPV, they have publicly admitted in the past, although not so loudly lately, that they think this is the foot in the door to eliminate the Electoral College. And in fact, Vic Amar, you'll recognize his name, I know many of you will, just wrote an article very recently where he basically said, ultimately, we're going to go for elimination of the Electoral College, just like the 17th Amendment. This is how we got the 17th Amendment. You know, we got people to promise, and that's true. It was a very slow process, and over time, the amendment seemed like not such a big deal. So I will agree with Pat, until I'll wrap up, I will agree with Pat, that states do have a great deal of discretion in how they allocate their electors to represent their citizens the most fairly, but they do not have the power to allocate their electors in some way that violates some other portion of the Constitution. If they were to allocate their electors based on a men-only election, we would all know that that was void. Likewise, if you were to allocate your electors in violation of Article 5, that is void.
Yes.
One of the original drafts in the Constitution provided that the president would be elected by the state legislatures and be subject to a 7-year term, I believe. Given that history in the Constitutional Convention, is it fair to say that what we see in the Electoral College is a compromise, and we should think twice about whether we want to give up on that compromise from several centuries ago?
Yes, me?
Anyone that wants to answer.
Do you want to answer first?
Well, first of all, I don't know. So The truth is there was a vote to have the legislature select the president. There was also a vote to have and that failed at the Constitutional Convention, as did every other method they considered. When they took 30 votes over 22 separate days, they couldn't agree on how to elect the president. And so what they did is they formed an electoral college, and what they did is they granted the power to award electors to the body of government that was closest and most sovereign to the people, which was the legislature. So I think they were intentionally mute on method so that the legislature, right, in Madison's Republic, would determine how to use that power to award electors or direct electors in a way that would advance the interest of the states. And right now what you have is a system where 4 out of 5 states are using that power to make voters in 1 out of 5 states hyper-relevant. So I don't believe it was, I don't think there was any compromise on method. I think what they determined was we are gonna be moot on method, at which point all the legislatures went back and adopted different state statutes. And I'm just here to say that the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact is no more or less constitutional than a congressional district system or a plurality system or a legislative appointment, because if the legislatures determine it's in their best interest to award their electors on the basis of the national popular vote, that's what the founders would have them do. I also don't think there's anything constitutionally irrelevant about interstate compacts. The truth is that states are free to form agreements amongst themselves so that the states could be protected against the federal government. And if interstate compacts were unconstitutional, a lot of this country wouldn't have water, and we'd be free of Powerball. But interstate compacts are obviously appropriate. California is well within its right to join an interstate compact and to say, I don't want to award my 55 electoral votes unless it's gonna be decisive, because that's what makes every voter in California relevant, but it also makes every voter in North Dakota relevant too.
Thank you. So I have a liberal colleague at my law firm that I've convinced the Electoral College is legitimate. I mean, he concedes that it's a result of a bargain between the states and the smaller states, as Tara pointed out, were concerned. But he insists that, being a living, breathing Constitution guy, he insists that the small states have too much influence under the Electoral College. And so his idea is that the electoral votes that are accorded to each state should be, changed. The allocation should be changed. You should double them, do something. So my question is this: setting aside the constitutional and legislative mechanisms that would be required to make changes, just on the basic notion of the reallocation of votes, what are your thoughts about that?
I think you're asking, do the small states have too much power? Basically, okay. I'm going somewhere with this story. Back in the 1970s, there were civil rights leaders that were big advocates of the Electoral College. And it's kind of the opposite of what you hear today. Today you hear it's racist or something. But back then, mm-hmm. the civil rights leaders were big advocates. And one of the arguments that they made was that the reason that minority voters have more power with the Electoral College is because of their high concentrations in big cities. And in there are certain big cities where you can, and he used the word coalition building in the cities, which was interesting to me. But Vernon Jordan said, he was the person making this argument. Vernon Jordan said, look, you can congregate in these cities and you can run up the vote in the city and you can get the winner, the whole state, because of the winner take all allocation. Okay, a hard example, New York City. Of course, we all know that drives the outcome of New York, right? Or there are people in Pennsylvania that might complain that Philadelphia or Chicago drives Illinois. There are portions of the country where the big cities really do have a lot more power than the rural voters in those states. And the rural voters in New York, they don't feel like they've got too much power. They feel like they have zero power. Now, on the other hand, there's other parts of the country where there really is an advantage to those small state rural voters, and they do have much more of a leg up than they otherwise would. If for no other reason than the two Senate seat add-on that states like Wyoming get. So I look at it and I think this is a really fine, delicate balance. Sometimes big cities have more power. Sometimes the rural areas have more power. Sometimes it just kind of all evens out. And that's what the Electoral College is about. It's about balancing power between big and small states, rural and in big city, And everybody has a voice in their own way. And for a country that is big, as big and diverse as America, that is a beautiful thing.
I would just reject your premise. I mean, I think the small state protection is in the United States Senate. And the reason that electoral votes are based on total number of representatives in Congress was to get the big states to go to it. And I just point you to Delaware et al. Versus the state of New York, a bunch of small states that sued New York over their state-based winner-take-all law because they were completely ignored in presidential elections, right? They understood that New York, when it was a battleground state, had all kinds of power under the current system. Now, of course, the court told Delaware and North Dakota what they should do, which is pound sand, because what New York does with her electors is New York's problem. And just the idea that New York City controls the governorship in the state of New York, you know, ignores Rudy Giuliani, not even Rudy Giuliani, but Pataki, who was elected, reelected governor of the state of New York despite being crushed in the cities. So I'm not afraid of first-past-the-post systems, but I think small states get job more than any other kind of state under the current system because six of them are reliably Democrat, six of them are reliably Republican, and 10 of the 12 smallest states were absolute flyover states last election.
All right, we've got just a couple more minutes. Let's see if we can squeeze in two more quick questions.
Okay, on the compact, I think you said the advantage is that everybody's vote counts instead of just the battleground people's votes counting. It seems to me you just switched where you're going to campaign. If you have a compact, then it won't be the battleground states, but they're going to campaign in the big populous states to get their votes. So Vermont, who is a battleground state, we'll probably never see anybody if it's a popular vote one. So aren't you just switching it from the voters of the battleground states to the voters of the populist state if you do the compact?
A fair objection. I mean, I was concerned before I signed on of the very same thing. The truth is when I add up the population in the 12 biggest states, it's roughly 50% of the voting population of the country. And I would say that for every California, there's a Texas. Right, for every New York, there's a Georgia, right? And so if 50% of the people in a first-past-the-post system in a single-member district, the United States of America, live in the 12 biggest states, and 50% of the people live in all the other states, I don't know, I don't find it it wasn't a credible argument that I could make to myself that the smaller states would be ignored. What's going to happen is what happens in gubernatorial elections in places like Texas here, where the major population centers are Houston and Dallas in the suburbs. But the truth is Republicans drive their margin, campaign aggressively to rural Texas, carve into Democratic margins, you know, in the suburbs around Houston and Dallas. And I don't know how to say that every vote would be equal. Like, I don't know exactly what that means. But I do believe in first-past-the-post systems, candidate with the most votes wins. In single-member districts, every voter is politically relevant in every election. And I believe that Republicans and Democrats in Texas will matter under a national popular vote for president in a way that they don't matter so much under the current system. And if they start to matter because they're a battleground state, I think we're dangerously close to single-party control of presidential elections, which is a dangerous proposition for American politics and the body politic.
So I'm so sorry. Can I just say one thing?
Go ahead.
Okay. I'm just going to say one thing. I'm going to quote Pat down there. He said something earlier today in support of my notion that every state matters, every voter matters because of the Electoral College. Pat said, God help us if Texas becomes a battleground. Texas matters. Yes, we're a safe state, or we have been for a while. Texas matters. If we quit being safe, they care, okay? Every state matters. Texas simply made up its mind earlier in the process. That is the only difference between safe states and swing states. When did you make up your mind? Did you make up your mind early, or did you make up your mind late? And if a state starts to waver like Utah did in 2016 in the final days of the campaign, guess what? The party sends somebody out there to shore up support and make sure you do what you're supposed to do. I bet that Hillary really wishes she had not taken a bunch of blue wall states for granted, because those states cost her the election. Every state matters.
All right, one last question very quickly.
With apologies to our two middle panelists, this is also a compact question.
We're going to head down to the reception, so.
Thank you. understanding that our two speakers on the compact concept and the Electoral College have what was surprising to me, a remarkable amount of agreement as to the importance of states having the ability to make these allocative decisions for themselves. I find myself thinking that I remember that there is no constitutional mechanism to break an interstate compact. Am I wrong there? Is there such a provision?
Yeah, well, there are provisions within the compacts, right? So for example, National Popular Vote, the Interstate Compact, stipulates that any state can withdraw from the compact at any time, but their withdrawal cannot take effect within a 6-month window from July 20th of a presidential year until after the next president sworn in. It's a 6-month period. Now, no state can withdraw from an interstate compact without adhering to the terms of the compact, right? Because it's enforced by the impairments clause of the Constitution, compacts being contracts amongst the state. And I guess I'd point you to Virginia versus Tennessee, which would be the case that you'd want to look at there. So yes, you can withdraw from interstate compacts by adhering to the terms of the compact. The National Popular Vote Interstate Compact says you can vote to withdraw at any time, but your withdrawal cannot take effect within a 6-month window from July 20th of a presidential year until after the president is sworn in. And that it also has protections for the remaining compacting states, because it says that any time the compact dips below 270 electoral votes, which is the triggering mechanism, it says that all states revert back to their previous statute until such time as you're at 270 or more electoral votes in a presidential election year. So the remaining compacting states don't start from scratch. They just build towards 270. 270, of course, being a majority of the Electoral College, because no state wants to unilaterally disarm. That wouldn't make any sense. They want the payoff of all the voters being relevant.
I bet I can find a lawyer in this room who's going to argue that states are sovereign and
cannot
be bound.
They'd lose.
All right, let's continue the conversation at the reception. Join me in thanking our panelists.